Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anorexia is not just a favorite target of Hollywood paparazzi, shooting the emaciated frames and jutting shoulder blades of film stars on the famished edge. Anorexia is a killer. It has the highest death rate of any mental illness, almost 10%. But it is subtle, too, a complex outgrowth of predisposition and environment. And once it grabs a person with its food aversion and the self-medication of malnutrition, it is devilishly hard to shake. 2.5 million Americans suffer from anorexia. The poster child has been teenage girls, but it's boys too, and now a surge in anorexic kids as young as 9. Up next, On Point, new insights on the culture, brain chemistry, and psychology of anorexia. Joining us first from New York is Peg Tyre, senior writer at Newsweek magazine. She spent a year researching her cover story, Fighting Anorexia, No One to Blame, which appeared in the magazine this month. Peg Tyre, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
You've painted a great big picture of what's going on in so many households here. And at the heart of it is this notion that it's not just type A girls, white girls from privileged backgrounds. It's a much more complex picture of anorexia that you paint. What's it look like, Peg?
Well, clinicians across the country were telling me that for the last maybe six or seven years, they've been noticing that the profile of anorexia has changed. Many more younger children, many more males, both young boys and teenage boys, adolescent boys, also more middle-aged women. So it's really changed from being a disease that people thought afflicted wealthy, white girls who are between the ages of 15 and 22, and it's really morphed into something very different.
And the understanding of what causes it is changing too, as you describe it. I mean, you say at one time it was seen as an affliction of girls under tremendous pressure from parents and schools and coaches. They wanted to get some kind of control over their lives, and controlling their diets, minimizing them was a way, maybe the only way they felt they could do it. It now seems much more complex than that.
Well, for a long time, people believed it was something your parents did to you or something you were doing to your parents. Your parents were over-controlling, your parents were under-involved, or you were struggling for control or trying to separate from your parents and in a fight for maturity and a struggle towards maturity. But those sort of post-Freudian ideas really seem to be slipping away as scientists have begun to trace the genetic root and the sort of hardwiring component of anorexia. Certainly the environmental factors are key, but what we're reading more and more is that you have to be sort of hardwired to get it.
Peg, tell us some of the stories that you found of people, of families struggling with anorexia that stretch our understanding of it.
Well, many families that I spoke with, the mothers talked to me about watching their children get sick, and they said to me, I knew what I was seeing because I suffered through the same thing. And a very poignant story, a mother held her very skeletal daughter in her lap. She could count her ribs, and really the most prominent feature was her teeth. And she said, I'm not going to let this happen to you. I'm not going to let this happen to you. And, of course, it was happening to her daughter. She had had a childhood experience very similar. And so many times parents talk about the fact that they see it in their children and they know the experience from their own childhoods. But in many cases, there is no clear genetic component, and parents don't know what they see. And that's even sort of more confusing, because who would think that a 9-year-old would restrict their eating to the point of being malnourished and near death?
And 9 years old, you cite that. I've seen numbers as young as eight. Are these, very rare outliers, or is this sort of affliction of teenagers, as we think of it, really moving into that age American?
You know, the question of whether it's I know I used the word morphed previously, and the question of whether it's changing or whether we're looking at it differently is a good one. I'm not clear, and I don't think there's any real answer as to whether anorexia is really changing or public awareness has grown and that doctors are picking it up in different age groups more frequently. So as the profile changes, the awareness changes, and doctors who might previously say, oh, the child has a failure to thrive or the child is sickly, mm-hmm. now say the child is restricting their eating and suffering from malnutrition.
Let's move in a little more closely even here, if we can. Peg Tyre with Newsweek, standby. I want to welcome into our conversation from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Cynthia Bulick. She's director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, professor in eating disorders in the Department of Psychiatry and a professor of nutrition in the School of Public Health there, co-author of Runaway Eating. This goes in the other direction. Cynthia Bulick, thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
So would you just define this for us to begin with? When do you just have a child or a person who wants to be very trim, and when do you have an anorexic?
Well, I think what we're seeing is, as Peg said, so many more young girls and boys, 7, 8, 9 years old, who really are putting themselves in a position of becoming malnourished as children. And in many of these children, it's motivated by initially the diet. I mean, what we say is dieting is the biggest risk factor for developing anorexia nervosa. And what we'll probably talk about later is that biologically, these young children who are vulnerable to anorexia nervosa respond differently to diets than everyone else.
Now, what do you mean by that? Let's go straight to it. I mean, one of the things that Peg describes, this was news to me, was a kind of an anorexia, a malnutrition high or calm when serotonin activity is suppressed because of the low food intake. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, I really like the word calm, because what we see in these girls and in older people with anorexia is that they're hardwired in a way that makes them very anxious. And as you know, if you've ever missed a meal, most of us, when we miss meals, we tend to get more antsy and more anxious and forage around for food.
I sure
but
do.
What a lot of these kids experience is that they actually find that starvation decreases their anxiety and does create a sense of calm for them. And that's what enables them to keep going on starving.
So how is that cycle, how is it kicked off? How does it begin? I mean, surely just saying, oh, I'm on a diet and skipping a meal or two doesn't do it. Is it months and months, this descent into anorexia or something else?
Well, I think it can go two ways, but like I always tell parents, if your 7, 8, or 9-year-old child comes home and says, I'm going to go on a diet, you should be as concerned as if that child came home and said, I'm going to try my first cigarette, or I'm going to have a beer after school. This is something that we should really have our awareness raised to, because dieting at that age, or extreme dieting, can be the trigger that sets off this cycle.
And Peg Tyre, once people are into this, as you describe it, very difficult to climb out. I was stunned by this 10% death rate, 5 to 10, I'm looking at other stories as well here, among anorexics, half that who don't recover from anorexia. I mean, that's a terrible sentence, Peg.
And chronic anorexia, talking to the families who've suffered with family members who have it, is a devastating and terrible disease. Families, the parents, they remortgage their house trying to get treatment for their child. They go bankrupt ultimately. The children are unable to live independently, and they're in this terrible, angry, frozen cycle of sort of delusional thinking about themselves and about their family and their bodies. It's the toll that it takes on a family, chronic anorexia takes on a family, is really something you have to almost see to believe.
Cynthia Bulick, is it genetic? Is it like alcoholism? Is it more akin to depression? Is there a parallel you can draw?
Well, I'll pick that question apart a little bit. As Peg mentioned before, so many of these families say, oh, yeah, I've seen that in my Aunt Susie, or I remember going through something like that when I was a kid. But what we're dealing with is the fact that back then there might not have been a label for it. So there might be someone in the family who had anorexia or bulimia, but it was never detected. We found that family members of people with anorexia are at 7 to 12 times at greater risk for developing an eating disorder than family members of people without anorexia. And we've taken that further now to actually put numbers on just how heritable it is. So somewhere between 50 and 80% of your risk for developing anorexia or bulimia nervosa is due to genetic factors.
We're joined right now from Omaha, Nebraska, by Kristen Bishop. She's 19 years old, a college student. She's battled with anorexia. She was hospitalized several times, beginning when she was 16. She was treated in the eating disorders program at Children's Hospital in Omaha. Kristen, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom. How are you?
We're well. If you'd be good enough, I wish you'd take us back to when anorexia first began to get its hooks into you. How did it unfold?
It's really hard to pinpoint a beginning, but growing up, I had really low self-esteem, and it compounded as I got older, and going into those teen years, I just thought that I would be more accepted if I lost more weight, and I did, and it got out of control, and that's how I ended up in the hospital.
So you felt that if you were thinner, you'd be more attractive, more popular, more accepted?
Right.
So were you addicted to the mirror in those days? Were you constantly watching the progress of the downward weight?
I definitely, yeah, and the scale is something that I would check very often. And, you know, in the beginning, it wasn't even about the weight. It was just, oh, I want to get healthy, I want to get fit. And I got addicted to the feeling of losing weight.
And how did your eating habits change, Kristen? And was it public or was it secret?
Oh, it was definitely secret. That's something that you don't want your parents or your friends to notice, because if they notice how little you're eating, then they're going to want you to eat more, and that's something that I didn't want to do.
So how did you do it? How did you avoid the pressure from parents and peers to eat more?
I would lie and say I'd eaten with friends when I hadn't. Or I would just say I wasn't hungry and I'd eat later. And if I did end up having to eat, I would eat a little bit and then go work on homework or things like that. It was always later that I'd eat.
And when did this peak? You're 19 now, you were 16 then. When was the worst of it, Kristen?
It was definitely when I was 16.
How low did your weight go?
That's something that I'd rather not talk about. But
because it's embarrassing, or because you're afraid to sort of trigger the magnetism of those numbers again, or why?
It's really because I think that we put too much of importance on weight as just basically as a society and by saying it. But I will tell you that when I was in the hospital, if your weight was under a certain percentage, which I don't remember what it was, of the normal weight, you were put in a wheelchair. And I was put in a wheelchair, and I couldn't walk around because they wanted me to conserve as much energy as possible, and I just didn't think it was very safe for me to be walking around.
Oh, so you were way down there. And how did you turn this around, Kristen? Have you?
Oh, I definitely have. I've recovered completely. I have my life back, and the eating disorder is not part of my life at all, and I am so happy with where my life is right now.
How did you do it? Was it force feeding? Was it a sessions with a psychiatrist? How did you get yourself out of the headlock?
I went through a lot of therapy, and I was in the hospital quite a bit. And when I was going through recovery, I definitely needed a lot of structure, because when I was first put into treatment, I did not want to be there. I wanted the eating disorder as part of my life. And so I was forced to eat, but I didn't actually fully recover until I could have the power to do it on my own. And I had to decide for myself.
And do you still feel vulnerable to anorexia, or do you think you've put that behind you permanently?
I've put that behind myself permanently, and actually I've used that to help me in my career, because I'm in college right now. I'm studying to be a therapist and hopefully help kids who have gone through what I've gone through.
Well, so you're going to push it right on. Kristen, I know we have to let you go, but we're very grateful to you for sharing your story. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Cynthia Bulick, what do you hear in the story? You see many cases of anorexia. Kristen, it was at its worst at 16. Now she's 19 and in university and feels cured, if that's the right word. Is that a standard sort of arc of anorexia?
Well, I think first off, it's so important to say thank you to Kristen and just to acknowledge that it's not easy to come on and tell your story, and we really appreciate that. And yes, her story is quite typical and promising in some ways. I think it's a nice counterpart to what Peg was talking about before in terms of the chronic cases. You know, Kristen acknowledged how difficult it is to overcome this disorder. And she also talked about that end push that really had to come from herself when something inside her was finally able to get past her biology and really come out the other end of anorexia nervosa.
So is there something in our culture today that is pushing up the numbers here, or are we just recognizing anorexia more widely? Is there a big pathology at work in the country, you know, at all ends of the food obsession spectrum?
I think what we're talking about is that the nature of the environmental triggers has changed, and when they hit has changed. So, for example, and I think Peg mentioned this in her article, you know, one of the lines I use a lot is genes load the gun for anorexia and environment pulls the trigger.
Yep.
And what we're seeing is we're seeing triggers now that hit in elementary school.
What do you mean by
and
triggers?
Well, a trigger can be that first diet. So, you know, a bunch of little girls in the third or fourth grade are sitting around saying, I'm fat, and they all decide to go on a diet together. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago. And we have to be especially careful now in the midst of the obesity epidemic, where there's so much talk about dieting and healthy eating. We need to make sure that all of those interventions that we're doing to prevent obesity and overweight in children aren't giving me more business. I don't want them to create more eating disorders.
Mm. Tori is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Tori. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What's your story, Tori?
Well, I have been struggling with anorexia for 5 years, in and out of a few different hospitals.
How old are you now, Tori?
I am 18.
Are you over it or still struggling?
Well, I'm in recovery, and I'm pretty much in control of it. I don't think I'll ever get as bad as I had gotten.
How bad did it get?
I had been admitted into numerous hospital situations, sometimes into the intensive care unit.
And your weight, how low did it go?
It went below the 15th percentile for my height at the time, and my heart really took a toll from it.
Beneath 100 pounds, beneath 90 pounds?
Yeah, beneath 90.
Tori, what's your sense in your own case of why you've been hit by this? Does it seem like something that's in the genes? Does it seem like pressure in your family or community? Does it seem that you're responding to national ads and movie stars who are skinny? How do you interpret your own situation?
Well, I agree with the other caller that it is definitely a need to sort of fit in to be a certain way or you're not acceptable. And there are probably certain genetic traits that I'm sure, like anorexia, I've heard is a form of obsessive compulsive disorder, certain genes, but food is such a huge part of every human being's life that to say that the way they were raised or the way they have gone through life has, I guess, taken a backseat to genetics, I don't think makes sense.
So the environment, the upbringing, the culture around you, you're seeing is right in there. Cynthia Bulick, I mean, it's kind of the classic story here, and Tori still wrestling with this. You know, what do you say to someone? Tori's now 18. Is there a rule of thumb? Is it just encouragement and a hug? What do you say to someone who's struggling with this?
Well, encouragement and a hug isn't enough to get over anorexia nervosa, but encouragement is critical. And, you know, everyone's trajectory is different. Recovery rates are different for different people. And you have to be very frank about what it's like to get over anorexia. It can take anywhere from 5 years to 10 years to sometimes longer. And even people who are recovered need to be vigilant for signs. It's sort of like someone who stopped smoking and all of a sudden they might get a whiff of a cigarette and suddenly those cravings might come back. The same thing can happen when people have storms in their life. So someone might be recovered from anorexia nervosa or almost recovered from anorexia and face a tragedy or a serious event or a transition. And some of those urges to restrict might come back again. And whenever you face those sorts of transitions, you have to keep your eyes open to make sure those symptoms aren't coming back and use whatever tools you got in treatment to keep yourself from slipping again.
And what about this line between fitness, Peg Tire, and anorexia? I mean, we've got an obesity problem at another end of the scale in this country. Students are encouraged to be fit, and the media message is out there saying be fit also, be trim. So how do you encourage being trim without triggering the anorexia path, Peg?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure that there's any broad way of addressing young children about the issue of anorexia. I know that there's work done in schools, and I think that there's work done to raise awareness of what an eating disorder is, but I'm not sure that I haven't heard anything that convinces me that you can actually prevent it in kids who are going to go in that direction. But I think what I would caution parents, and I think what pediatricians are trying to reach parents with, is that you have to watch out for it, and that when you're, as Cynthia Bulick said, when your child says, your 7-year-old says, I'm going to go on a diet, or I'm going to join the gymnastics team, or both those things at the same time, these are not neutral activities for someone who's hardwired for anorexia, and you have to be very careful. And if you know that your child may have a latent vulnerability to this, you have to pay close attention to what they're actually doing, what they're eating, and what their eating habits are like. I just want to say one thing. I know that you're asking anorexics about their weight and how low they got down to.
Yes, and we feel a resistance to that.
And there's a big resistance to that, and I'm sure your listeners are wondering, well, why? And, you know, as a reporter, I ran into this all the time. You should know that for anorexics, that's an incredibly loaded question for them.
Because
they obsess about their weight, and they obsess about ounces, about their weight down to ounces.
Wow.
And so to ask them to dwell on the time when they were sickest and most obsessed is to really send them, you know, ask them to revisit that incredibly difficult time in their life. And, you know, the really healthy ones, they don't want to talk about weight anymore. They're like over the whole like measuring their weight and measuring their sickness by their weight. They just want to put it behind them and live like the rest of us do, which is to eat normally. And when your pants get too tight, then you stop, don't have another dish of turkey for Thanksgiving. But they don't really want to focus in on weight. Now, you and I use it as a marker. You know, how sick
sure.
were you? What
mm-hmm.
did you use? What
mm-hmm.
did you weigh? But they don't really want to go back
to them,
there.
It's like going back in the box. They don't want to be there. And who can't understand that? Yeah.
It's like asking a depressive, well, how did you try and kill yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a very difficult thing for them to talk about. It's hard for us to understand people who don't have that obsession.
Mm. Joining us from Northern Virginia, Laura Collins. Her daughter was 12 years old when she was diagnosed with anorexia. The family went through quite a trial in figuring out how to respond. She's written about it in a book called Eating With Your Anorexic, How My Child Recovered Through Family-Based Treatment, and Yours Can Too. Laura Collins, thank you for joining us.
I'm pleased to be with you, Tom.
So describe what happens to a family when suddenly you've got this in your midst. You've got a child, a daughter in your case. She's anorexic, and now you need to do something about it. What's the world look like at that point?
It looked like we had fallen down the rabbit hole. We really were terribly confused by it. We were blindsided, as most families are. You're just not trained to know what to do when mental illness hits your family.
Did you feel guilty? Did you feel like it was your fault? Peg Tire has written about how traditionally that this was seen as the suffocating parents and all the rest. Did that hit you?
Oh, absolutely. I had absorbed a lot of those ideas just through the culture, and then, of course, I picked up every book I could about the illness, and that just compounded my sense of guilt and responsibility, and it was crippling.
You write that your daughter, and there's a little bit of shielding names here, but we'll call her Olympia, you do, dropped 21 pounds in 2 months. What age and what kind of girl was this? What was the profile?
She was fairly typical for what we look at as, the anorexic type child. She was good in school. She was 14. She was an athlete, healthy emotionally, had a healthy attitude about food. We're a close family. It was one of those before pictures that was very, very nice.
When you went to the hospital, and you did that solve it? How did they respond?
Absolutely not. We first went to our family doctor, who said that my daughter needed more salt. Although she was fainting, she had been complaining that she weighed too much, and she presented exactly as any anorexic would. The pediatrician just didn't see that or didn't say that. Then we went to a succession of therapists who sent us off into one room, brought her into their room, and talked to her about body image and the media, and tried to discern whether she had been abused. And this, of course, did nothing either. She just became more and more sick.
And finally, you turned to kind of a home therapy, a home remedy, though a well-known one. It's been called the Maudsley approach, refeeding. How did you turn the corner with Olympia?
Well, the first thing that happened is we didn't know about it. We kind of came to the idea when we brought her to an eating disorder center, and they, without any medical records, without talking to me, with nothing but a check, brought her into a room, and after an hour brought me in, sent her into the hall, and told me that they had told her that she would now be living at the eating disorder center for the next 6 weeks, that she wouldn't see me, and that we could visit her after 6 weeks and stay at the Ronald McDonald House with her while they continued to treat her.
Your young daughter informed you of this, and off you were to go. Did you try it? Did you do it?
No, we brought her home. We said, you know, we were in shock. We were scared. We went from a therapist saying, you know, it's not about food and, you know, you just have to back off, to an eating disorder center taking over completely the parental role. So we went home and we said, well, you know, we're going to do what the hospital would do, which is you're going to need to eat. And mm-hmm. from that day, she ate full meals. I won't say it was easy, but once we discovered the Maudsley approach, or as it's sometimes called, the Maudsley approach, mm-hmm. once we discovered that this was an accepted standard of care in the UK, we read everything we could about it and compiled a team that would help support us do that at home.
Cynthia Bulick, when Laura Collins did this, one therapist told them what they were doing was monstrous. Describe for us how someone in your situation helps advise between hospitalization for anorexia and home treatment, Maudsley approach. How do you see it, Cynthia?
Well, they're not necessarily incompatible in some ways. I mean, I think the most important point to get across here is that parents are our best allies when it comes to treating especially young patients with anorexia nervosa. The old parentectomy approach didn't help anyone. It terrorized the children, it terrorized the parents, and it just perpetuated this whole issue of blaming the mother or blaming the father.
Just ask on that point, because Laura Collins said that the therapists were probing about abuse. I mean, is there often blame, just to be very clear about it, or is that, you know, some old urban legend?
It takes a long time to change the healthcare profession's view of what causes a disorder. And unfortunately, people with anorexia nervosa and their families have been done a huge disservice by old theories that really do focus on parent blaming.
And so were those theories dead wrong, or it's a mix of responsibility here?
From my perspective, parents of people with anorexia nervosa are some of the most concerned parents I've ever met in my life.
So the Maudsley approach, Laura, how does it work? I mean, you just sit and wait for Olivia, to eat?
It was a lot harder than that. And there are methods of doing this, and you have to create support. The bottom line is you treat food like you would treat chemotherapy. It's not fun. Your hair falls out. You know, chemotherapy is not something that anyone wants to do, and they need to be supported, loved, but very, very firmly held to getting the treatment that they need. And if you're suffering from malnutrition, you need food. And any treatment that doesn't include food is a problem for me.
But is it as simple as sitting at the table just waiting for the child to eat that meal? I mean, it could take all day, but...
No, absolutely. It really is hard, and I don't want to try mm-hmm. to minimize the difficulty, mm-hmm. but the option is not to not have difficulty. The child is going to have difficulty refeeding in a hospital, separated from their family. The longer they go without eating well, they're going to be more ill. So my job as a parent who's been through this is to tell people, look, there is an option out there. Start earlier than we start currently. don't wait until they're ready to be hospitalized to make sure that they're getting full supported nutrition.
And refeeding simply means getting them reaccustomed to eating or something else?
As I see it, two-pronged. One is nutrition and the other is desensitized to the fear of eating. And there's a whole theory behind this that people can research, but first we have to get beyond the idea that, one, parents shouldn't be involved, and two, that it has to happen outside the home. The home can have a real important role here, and I, as a parent, felt that most of the treatment professionals that I encountered and still encounter are very suspicious of this idea, very reluctant, and I'd like to see parents ask for this treatment, and I'd hope that that demand would lead to more supply.
Suspicion. Let me turn to our listeners again. A lot of them want to join us. Patty's calling from Nashville. Hi, Patty. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well. What do you know, Patty?
Well, I myself was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa back in 1971. I spent my 13th birthday in the hospital, and at that time, I mean, there might have been eating disorder centers. I seriously doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I was put in a hospital with... It was a ward where other pediatric patients were, but that had basically incurable diseases.
Did you know what was going on, Patty? Did you know you were...
I did. It was mm-hmm. my personal world, and I did not speak about it to anybody. The day that this doctor, who was a substitute, figured out what was gone, he put his finger on my nose and said, "Gotcha." And that was the moment I was unable to walk. I was down to little less than 55 pounds. I haven't grown any since then. I mean, in height, you know.
And how did you turn it around then? Did the doctor say you're going to eat this cheeseburger, or what happened?
Yeah, they force-fed me, but it was not. I did not get well by their force-feeding.
Mm-hmm.
I got well because the same power that gave me to not eat was the same power that I just decided to use to not even so much eat, but just live.
And Patty,
and then my daughter, my oldest daughter, is suffering with anorexia. She's very verbal about hers. I mean, eating is in every sentence. She weighs everything. You know, I didn't even have a scale. You know? So
it has passed down in your family. And is your daughter getting better treatment than you did?
No, I don't believe so. I believe now that they know what, I mean, now the insurance cuts her off after a week, saying only after her heart begins to fail to a greater degree will she be allowed back in the hospital. So everything's out of pocket. And my parents, unfortunately, are living in the same town where she is, so they're seeing it twice.
Wow, in you and then in their granddaughter. Patty, thank you very much for that story. Peg Tyre, you write about how insurance can fail people here, how the economic impact of dealing with anorexia can be devastating for families.
It's really very sad. Parents will spend anything, and eating disorder clinics will take all your money. It's very expensive treatment. It's residential. Sometimes it's $10,000 to $30,000 a month. Insurance doesn't cover it in the way that you would think. If you had a child who had mental illness, some other kind of mental illness, you would hope that your insurance would give you more financial support. But it's really quite astounding how out on a limb these people are, and really they go bankrupt, because who wouldn't? If you thought you had a choice between spending money or going into spending money you don't have, going into debt in order to save your child.
Thalia's calling from Boston. Hi, Thalia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling because I sense that I've heard a lot of the disorders be classified as mental illnesses and
yes.
You know, all internal. And there are many authors, including ones like Susan Bordeaux, who suggest that it's much more a reaction to social conditions, and that it isn't actually about food, it's about control. And when people, especially women, feel out of control, that they react by controlling the one thing they have agency over,
right,
in their bodies.
So you're not buying the kind of genetic predisposition, mental illness description, or the weight that's been given to that?
I think that there is not such a clear divide between nature and nurture or culture and our genetics, and it's not that one is more prevalent than the other, but I would argue that it is not a psychological disorder more than a social construct as well.
Talia, let us pick that up. Cynthia Bulick, you're a psychiatrist here. We've heard your description, but what about it? The relative weight of the pressure of society, the elements at work here, how exactly do you divide those up?
Well, following along that line, I never say nature versus nurture. I always say nature and nurture and look at each one and what the proportions are. And I don't see a big incompatibility because, you know, talking about anorexia as a way of gaining control really can mean both psychological, social, and biological. And it's compatible with what I was talking about earlier in terms of controlling that out-of-control biology when someone's so anxious. But we have to worry about going too far with just looking at the sociocultural explanations, because that's actually one of the reasons that we have difficulty getting insurance coverage sometimes. Because people who believe just the pure sociocultural theories, and I'm not saying that's what the caller was talking about, say, hey, this is a disorder of choice. Why should we cover this? But yet when we can really say to them, there's a biological underpinning to these disorders and there's a genetic component, we might have a little bit more traction in trying to overcome this tragedy of not getting insurance.
May I speak as a parent about that?
Laura Collins, please.
The issue of whether it's a choice or not and whether this is a real illness, and I'm speaking as someone who did the treatment for free. So I don't have a...
Did it for free, meaning you did it yourself at home.
Yeah. The insurance issue doesn't come into it. I've got to say, my child was controlled by her illness, and most people need some sort of an external control to help them get to the point where they can take that personal control back over.
But isn't the, you say controlled by the illness, but is the illness itself a disorder of choice, a social disorder in some part, or you don't buy that, Laura?
Well, I got to tell you that as a parent, the fact that I believe that this is a real illness, like an obsessive compulsive disorder like diabetes, that can be acted upon in behavioral ways, that freed me up as a parent to not be guilty and not to be angry at my daughter for her illness and to work with her against the illness. So it was really, really empowering to me. I think that both aspects of, I mean, that they're not in opposition, but I can say that as a parent, being told that this was a real illness that, you know, I had permission to help my daughter with because she had lost control for, you know, through it, that really helped me.
Cynthia Bulick, we've just got a couple more minutes, and Peg, I want to get to you as well, but as a country, how could we sort of recalibrate our big messages about food and body image to make the environment a little less trigger-happy here?
Well, I think we have to not do what we commonly do, and that is get dwarfed by the entertainment industry and by advertisements. We have to really keep pushing to get more realistic body images out there and to do whatever we can to give messages at home that buffer our children against those pervasive societal messages that say, hey, the only way to be okay is to be thin.
And Peg Tyer, finally to you, the message you heard across that year of talking with families where anorexia had hit, what's the takeaway, bottom line, from the families themselves?
So many of these families suffered so greatly as their child ran through the course of this disease. In one particular case, the child had cancer, and the community rallied around this child and helped support the family while she had cancer. And then later she developed an eating disorder, and there was only silence from her community. And the experience of that so scarred the parents, and many of these families feel very scarred and very frightened and very blamed. And I've rarely met parents who are more caring, and it's just a shame what the stigma they have to suffer with. And I guess that was sort of my takeaway. It's just that they're under a terrible burden.
Well, we appreciate the learning you've all helped us do in this hour. Peg Tyer at Newsweek, thanks for some tremendous reporting there, and thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Laura Collins, there in Virginia, author of Eating With Your Anorexic. We're glad your daughter's doing better, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Cynthia Bulick, co-author of Runaway Eating, director of the Eating Disorders Program at the University of North Carolina. Thanks, Cynthia, for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.